Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the critically acclaimed Streaming Club, the movie review podcast you're listening to right now.
Thank you, Rodney.
My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
Very descriptive. My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I don't have a cute nickname. I don't need one.
And I was being cryptic in our opening because I feel like it's in the title. Like, we're streaming movies.
it's our streaming club.
Yeah.
This was, until just recently, part of our new film releases. We incorporated it during the pandemic when people were staying at home and watching a lot more on streaming. So we're catching up on classics. Now that the world is very slowly leaking back out to normalcy, mm-hmm. in a very disappointing sort of way, we're splitting off. We're going to keep on watching classic films on streaming, and but we feel have like it be its own entity now.
We feel like they deserve their own chapter here at the critically acclaimed network legacy library. Wow. I'm just not talking good today.
Welcome to the critically acclaimed legacy library. Should start selling books like Matt Zoller Sites.
It'd just be, no, what we would have is we would just have like the scrap paper where we had all of our top 10 lists and everything.
Oh,
and
they usually just end up in a pile
or get thrown away.
I think I have an old notebook.
We laminate them and you can like check them out. I'm like, ooh, look at that Whitney Seibold doodle.
I remember going to see the Tim Burton exhibit at LACMA, the LA County Museum of Art. And it was just sort of a big celebration of his art, and had like some of his like props from some of his movies,
mm-hmm.
some of
his
own original illustrations and sculptures that he had done. But they were also trying to give like a whole look at what his life was like, and they actually found like papers he wrote in the fourth grade that his parents still had in the attic. It's like, why do I need to see this? This is not illuminating Tim Burton. Well,
did you read them? Maybe they did illuminate them. Like, one of these days when I direct Batman, I'm going to make sure it's nothing but the Riddler. We'll be like, ooh, he changed his mind.
No, no, it was just him writing papers on a fourth grade level because he's in the fourth grade.
Nah, I don't know. Yeah. No, they must have. They had their reasons.
Like, what led Tim Burton into film? Well, he grew up in Burbank. And he lived near Disney, and he watched those movies, and he worked for Disney. It's like the most uninteresting origin story.
I'm sure there was a little more to it than that, but basically.
Speaking of origin stories.
Go on.
The film we're covering this week on the critically acclaimed Streaming Club, Library of Libraries, has a really interesting backstory.
It
was adapted from a novel, and it was such a notorious stinker that a book has been written about its making.
There's a best-selling novel that was led to the movie we're reviewing today on the Streaming Club, and that movie was such a disastrous production that it led to a best-selling non-fiction book. And I kind of want to see the movie based on that other book, because that would probably be better than Brian De Palma's The Bonfire of the Vanities.
He's a Wall Street tycoon. She's his Fifth Avenue mistress. They're in the right car, taking a wrong turn.
Sherman, Sherman!
I'm a reporter craving a story.
This is Peter Fallon, the has-been.
In a city hungry for headlines.
How did I get to be so important?
You're not important. Just dinner.
I'm the one who's driving the car, Sherman.
Just sit back and watch the sparks fly.
Look at him!
The Bonfire of the Vanities.
Some backstory in The Bonfire of the Vanities.
Well, first of all, the title comes from like medieval poetry, an ancient Catholic tradition where you would burn the things that encouraged vanity. Vanity is a deadly sin. So,
it's a vice.
It is a vice. So yeah, burn your mirrors, burn your makeup, burn the things that you would make you take pride in your appearance, because that is but a distraction from the wholesomeness of Christ.
The original novel was written by Tom Wolfe, who you probably know from writing The Right Stuff, which is considered one of the best films about like sort of the space race. And
he was also just a really interesting, hard-hitting journalist, where he did a lot more straightforward form of journalism. It was very literary.
Yeah,
he was a very literary journalist, and that was sort of a big movement in journalism, starting in like the 60s.
Yeah, his first novel was The Bonfire of the Vanities, and was originally in a very Dickensian way, serialized in the pages of Rolling Stone magazine. Mm-hmm. And then after the story had been completed, he did some rewriting and published it as a novel. The novel was a major bestseller. It was very celebrated. Some have called it one of the quintessential novels of the 1980s, at least in terms of the representation of American culture in that time. The story of, I'm just giving you the quick gist of it, is about a Wall Street broker, trader, millionaire, who has it all. Is cheating on his wife, and one night while he is out with his mistress, they end up taking the wrong turn off of the highway and enter into the wrong part of town.
That is the black neighborhood.
Yeah, they end up...
And that's very pointed. Yeah. This is a takedown of like racist attitudes of wealthy white people. That's a big part of the novel.
They panic, they freak out, they end up committing a hit and run, and they drive off, and the young man who has been run over ends up becoming part of a media firestorm thanks to a reporter who is on the outs and is looking for a salacious tale in order to get his career back in order. And the Wall Street broker ends up becoming a media pariah becomes like a tool for, you know, the mayor's office, the church, and basically everyone in New York has something they want to gain out of this media frenzy. And that's the gist of the tale. As you can imagine, just from hearing that, it sounds like A, there's a lot in that story. Hmm. And B, that is a tightrope walk.
Well, I think this type of cultural satire, it feels to me like it was a lot more common in the 1980s. It came out the same year as something like RoboCop, which is a really salacious...
The novel.
The movie came out the same year as the movie RoboCop, and that is a very salacious satire of privatization. It was around the same time as Wall Street, the Oliver Stone movie.
They Live, in which the rich are literally aliens who are trying to take us over and brainwash us into capitalist complacency.
What year was American Psycho?
The novel or the movie?
The movie was 2000, but the novel was I think, late 80s, early 90s.
I think you're right. Let me double check.
It was part of the same miasma, anyway. This was all...
91, so it came out right after.
Right after.
Yeah.
It was all part of this, this sort of miasma of criticism of Reagan culture. How wealth and emptiness and spectacle and media manipulation became just sort of de rigueur. Mm-hmm. And Tom Wolfe was criticizing that. Brian De Palma either misunderstood, didn't understand what was going on with a story like that, or was deliberately trying to change it into something beholden to his own interests.
You say that, but having witnessed the film, and I'm a fan of Brian De Palma, I don't think everything he's done is great. But I think he's done many great films.
He's done some really awful movies.
He's done some truly awful films. But to his credit, he has also made some truly classic films, many of them in the thriller genre. Mm. Films like Body Double, Sisters, Raising Cain, which apparently he developed while working on Bonfire of the Vanities to keep his own sanity. Because it was that difficult for him.
That bad a production.
Raising Cain is super underrated. He's made a lot of really... The Untouchables is one of my favorite cop movies ever made. Terrible History, great movie.
And then he did Carrie.
And he did Carrie, the first Stephen King adaptation. And so he's had a great career, and he's made some crap. And usually, Phantom of the Paradise as well, so he can do comedy.
But he's also done, like, when he's working for hire, he's a less interesting director.
Yeah. Mission Impossible is good.
It's a weird... I think Mission Impossible is a weird beast.
True.
Like, I enjoy watching it because it feels, like, so terse and clinical, but it's all... But it's trying to sell itself as a blockbuster, which it clearly isn't interested in being.
It's kind of a takedown, actually, of the original series, which is basically just like, yay, the American government! And in Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible, like, the villain is... the hero from the original series who kind of only existed in a morally corrupt paradigm. And when you remove the Cold War and take away any sort of like moral compass, we realize he was always a monster.
Yeah.
And that was actually really controversial to fans of the show. We forget about it now because now the movies are more popular than the series was. But yeah, that was like, I'm trying to think of an example here. That would be like,
If they did a Star Trek reboot and Kirk was the villain.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be pretty controversial to a lot of people. And if the movie was good enough, a future generation wouldn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happened with Mission Impossible.
He also did, like, Mission to Mars, if you remember that movie.
I never saw that one.
It's not good.
I've heard it's not good. He did, what was that one he did with Nicolas Cage? Snake Eyes, which is not...
Stylish, but not an interesting movie.
Brian De Palma, and he'll do it here, Brian De Palma is extremely fond of whirling dervish, look ma, watch me dive, cinematic show-offmanship.
He's very fond of that Steadicam.
Yes, he is.
He loves very long, sustained takes with Steadicams, and he's been very good, and puts this in multiple movies. The split screen, where he'll have two scenes playing simultaneously on the screen, and they will interact in an interesting sort of way.
Very few filmmakers are actively keeping that alive, and very few filmmakers have ever done it as well as Brian De Palma. But where was I going with this? So, like, he'll has a lot of broad cinematic trickery, but very rarely has it been done to as little effect as you'll see it in The Bonfire of the Vanities. The book was originally going to be adapted by Mike Nichols. Mike Nichols, the director of films like The Graduate and The Birdcage, is a funny director. And I think that might have been a good idea. The prompt for this week, by the way, wasn't comedy films on HBO Max, it was drama films on HBO Max. Mm. This is in the drama section. Because either they were trying to make a drama and they failed, or they were trying to make a comedy and they failed, and it's indistinguishable from a bad drama.
I think it's just a bad drama. Mm-hmm. Because this is a film that stoops to cheap moralizing. I'll just say it outright. The Bonfire of the Vanities, the film, is god-awful.
It's really bad.
It is as bad as its reputation.
You'll find a couple of good performances in the supporting cast here and there.
Yeah.
A couple of people who knew what kind of movie they were in, even though apparently Brian De Palma did not. But literally, almost the entire movie, it feels like a huge miscalculation. Mm. The timing feels off. The performances feel off. Like, Tom Hanks is playing his character like he's straight out of the Hudsucker Proxy. Like, he's playing it really broad in a way that, like, very few other characters are. And it's really weird and distracting to watch.
In casting Tom Hanks, who is... he's an incredibly sympathetic actor.
Mm-hmm. That's why they cast him. They thought the character was unlikable, so they got the guy who just done Big.
That's the fucking point of the movie. Know. But they cast Tom Hanks. Really wildly bad casting, because this is about a soulless, yuppie asshole who is cheating on Kim Cattrall. What? And, sorry. nobody thinks anything of him.
Yeah.
And his wife, when he goes to see his dad doesn't think a lot of him. And his wife describes what he does as, like, essentially doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you're... And, in fact, there's this speech about how, describing what he does, how, he, like, takes cake from one person, gives it to somebody else, and gets to keep a little crumb on the way. And if he does that enough, he gets to make a big pile of crumbs. That's all he does, is he collects crumbs of other people's cake.
He's a crummy guy.
Yeah.
And
he, of course...
Which is actually a pretty astute observation about how that gig works.
It's how it works, but of course it kind of humiliates him, because he feels like he's doing something kind of important. He's full of himself. He feels like he can't be touched. I feel like something like The Wolf of Wall Street really understands the moral depravity a little bit better.
The Wolf of Wall Street is exactly what The Bonfire of the Vanities thinks it is.
Which is hilarious, but it's also about the depravity.
Martin Scorsese is a highly moral filmmaker. Mm. People forget that because a lot of his movies feature, like, a lot of violence and a lot of horrifying things. But at the end of the day, a lot of them are basically Catholic parables.
Mm.
As a result, he knows who to be mad at. Like, we can laugh at them, sometimes even with them, but there's never a misguided sense of, oh, they're so great.
Yeah,
and I feel like The Bonfire of the Vanities as a movie, I've never read the book, but the movie hates these characters, but also thinks they're really fun.
Well, in casting Tom Hanks, it doesn't just think they're fun, it thinks he's worthy of sympathy.
Yeah, it makes him a martyr by the end. He's a dick.
His arc is... he goes into a bad neighborhood with his mistress.
Yeah. And by the way, quote-unquote bad neighborhood. Nothing even that bad happens to him.
I even describe it as a bad neighborhood. It's just, in fact, in the movie, they pull off the off-ramp, and Melanie Griffith, her character says, she actually says out loud, "Where are all the white people?" So this is establishing that these are racist people.
She in particular is a spectacularly racist, and Tom Hanks is no better.
And he doesn't use any slurs, but he just sort of rolls with it.
There's this clear absolute panic that they have. Exactly. That they've never been around this many people who weren't white before, let alone rich. And they're just terrified of everywhere that they go. There are people surrounding the car, and they're not white.
They even say phrases like "these people," like these, all these racist dog whistles. They're just shouting them out, and so he's a racist character. His mistress runs over a young black boy. Mm-hmm. And they flee the scene, hit and run. Mm-hmm. And his concern is...
There was a bit of an altercation, but nothing bad happened.
Nothing bad happened, like
it was kind of terse, but that was about it.
They weren't under any kind of direct threat.
Yeah.
They were just afraid of black people.
Yeah.
And they run over a black person.
Yeah.
And they flee the scene. And he's worried that he's going to get caught.
Yeah.
And his arc is... It eventually comes out what he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be fair, and I don't mean this to be fair as in he's innocent, but technically speaking, she was driving at the moment they hit the guy. Yeah. So he's in this weird position where, in order to protect this mistress that he has, he's throwing himself on top of the hand grenade.
Hmm.
If anything comes out, he's the one who's getting responsible for it because it was his car and he's not saying anything. And she convinces him, don't talk to anybody because then I'll get in trouble.
But so he's a terrible person. He's covering up a terrible crime.
Mm-hmm.
And the arc of the movie, according to De Palma, is that in becoming the center of this media firestorm, this like object of ire, that's where he finds his soul. And he is now a victim.
Right.
And he's depicted as being a victim, and he is the one that needs to be saved and redeemed.
No,
that's not the story. That's the story De Palma thinks this is.
No.
That's the role Tom Hanks is playing.
You could have maybe gotten away with that if by the end of the movie, Tom Hanks wasn't just trying to get away with... By the way, the kid they run over, in a coma, but alive.
Yeah.
This isn't technically murder, but it is really, really bad. No one's denying that. Instead of just like, he'll like get away with it. Because he's definitely at least an accessory.
Hmm.
He certainly aided and abetted covering up a crime. He's definitely guilty of shit. If at the end of the movie, he had gone so far as to, like, burn it all down. Hmm. Like, use everything he knew about every skeleton and every closet and, like, destroyed all of Wall Street. Maybe then I would buy this whole he redeemed himself shit.
Because he's from
an inherently corrupt world.
Hmm.
And we see that over the course of the film as people immediately turn on him whenever it's to their benefit. If he had seen that and like all of his eyes were open, like he put on the sunglasses from They Live and finally understood just how myopic he's been his entire life and then destroyed it, maybe he could have gotten away with that.
But in such a way where he doesn't become a good person.
Yeah.
Like, he is actually sort of a villainous character who's now destroying the system that raised him.
But I would have believed that. In kind of like this Alex Large kind of way or something like that. I would have believed
that. And then by the end, he ends up, like, openly committing murder, but he ends up, like, murdering other villains. It's this interesting moral parable, right?
I've never really seen Tom Hanks play that villainous a character.
He played a villain in a movie called The Circle, which was...
Yeah, I never saw that one.
Also quite a bad movie.
Is he like... really despicable on that though? Is he just like a corrupt like business guy?
He's not a corrupt business guy. He's like a villainous Steve Jobs, and it's like, oh yeah, I'm definitely mining data. And
Jobs? I'm sorry, that's no.
No, there's. I think we're still in the era where Steve Jobs is sort of like a cheap villain for screenwriters.
Yeah.
But yeah, he plays that kind of character, and in casting him, I think it was kind of wise because he's supposed to be benevolent to the world.
Yeah.
And you're not supposed to suspect him of anything.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that movie's so poorly made that it's not very interesting.
I'm actually trying to think of it now because again, Tom Hanks, funny actor, and this is still at a stage in his career where he'd done some interesting work, but he was almost exclusively known for comedy. Mm-hmm. He'd been nominated for an Oscar for Big, but that was still considered a comedy. He would do Philadelphia a year or two later, and that mm-hmm. would completely change his career around. But at this point in his career, he's the funny guy, and he's a very funny guy. He later proved that he was a really great at drama. Is this the worst Tom Hanks role you've ever seen? Because I'm thinking about his entire filmography.
Yeah.
From He Knows You're Alone, this first movie, it's a slasher. He's actually really good in it. Mm. Like, right off the bat, nailed it. I don't think I've ever seen a film where Tom Hanks is worse. Not just giving a bad performance, not just miscast, just completely wrong. Everything about him is wrong in this in this story.
He's really trying in Cloud Atlas. I don't think he's playing like 8 roles in that movie.
Some of them work better than others.
Some he's really good at, some not so much.
Yeah, that's fair.
This is
even
not...
The Lady Killers is not a good movie. He's funny.
He's great in that movie.
Yeah, he's really fun. I think the timing of that movie is just ruins all the comedy, but he's good in it.
We even go to this day. We go to restaurants and say we must have waffles forthwith, in the Tom Hanks style from The Lady Killers.
Yeah,
yeah. This he's completely miscast. Yeah. Bruce Willis kind of understands what he's doing in some scenes, but. Yeah.
Bruce Willis plays the reporter.
He's the narrator of the movie.
He's the narrator. We see at the beginning. There's actually a really bravura shot at the beginning of the movie where Bruce Willis is arriving in the basement of the World Trade Center and is taken on this one big epic oneer, like through like all the behind the scenes, like this big award ceremony where he's about to get an award.
Elevators and goes.
He's basically getting an award for writing The Bonfire of the Vanities, except in the world of the novel, it's a true story. And so we're seeing all of this stuff. It's kind of a shot that leads to nowhere. It's just De Palma showing off. It had to do with, they had to like hastily change the beginning of the movie. So they came up with an excuse for Brian De Palma to show off basically in order to just sort of open the movie with a bang. But, Bruce Willis plays the reporter who turned this thing into a media circus. And then over the course of the film realized that Tom Hanks, though a douchebag, didn't actually hurt the kid. Like, he wasn't actually driving, and so he's trying to sort of make things right.
If that was the perspective, if it stayed with him...
Maybe that would have been
better. And he was manipulating everything, and he realized this guy's terrible, but he doesn't deserve to be punished in this sort of way.
That might have been stronger. Yeah. You get this sort of... there's a wonderful... acidic Billy Wilder film called Ace in the Hole.
Yeah, I was just about to bring up Ace in the Hole.
Ace in the Hole stars Kirk Douglas as a really seedy reporter who comes across a mining disaster, and a bunch of guys are trapped in a mine, and Kirk Douglas, in an attempt to elongate the tragedy so that he can sell more papers than just a couple of days, does what he can to make it harder to rescue them. Boy, is that film evil, but great. It's really, really great.
But it's about the evil. It's about how this guy is morally bankrupt and how reporting is more about manipulation than it is about simply stating the facts.
There's so many brilliant movies about like evil reporter. Sweet Smell of Success is incredible.
Ooh, yes.
But of course, there are lots of films about noble reporting as well. Tom Hanks has been in a few. The Post, for example. But in any case, the character was originally written to be British, and they offered the role to John Cleese, who had turned it down, and a couple other people, like a couple other comedians, I think, as well. They had worked on it, and apparently this is another thing where the studio was said, Bruce Willis was just in Die Hard. Let's get Bruce Willis. And on one hand, Bruce Willis was known for comedy. He got his big start in Moonlighting. Mm. On the other hand, no one paid to see his comedies. In movie theaters.
Yeah.
Like, the only, like, hit comedy he'd been in, he wasn't in. It was Look Who's Talking. You can't see his face. Like, his other stuff, like Mystery Date. No one gave a shit.
Mm.
So, was it Mystery Date that was
his? No, it was Blind Date.
Blind Date. Mystery Date was, like, Ethan Hawke, right?
I don't remember. That was, was that The Sure Thing? No, that was...
No, The Sure Thing was John Cusack.
John Cusack.
Yeah. I think it was Mystery Date.
All
right. Anyway, so Bruce Willis was basically cast because he was big at the time. Tom Hanks was cast because he was big at the time and likable. And apparently this was a pretty common motif where the studio was just trying to get whoever they could get.
Well, we've talked before about how the art, or rather the artlessness of Hollywood casting.
Yeah.
I remember a casting agent came to my film school and talked about it. And we said, you know, how do you do it? Do you like sort of read this script and really sort of get into the head and try to figure out who would like has a history playing these types
who
of characters?
Be the most interesting actor.
And they said, we have a list of the most bankable stars in Hollywood and we start at the top.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
There
is the lead roles.
No other. They just go with the biggest star they can, and whoever shows up first, that's who they hire.
Yep.
And if somebody is willing, but they're asking for too high a price, they go to the next name.
Yep.
That's it.
That is. It's really uncomplicated. Yeah, so I've like when I was like working in development at places, there was done things where like, hey, we need to update the list. Go to the IMDb website and search for the most searched for actors.
Yeah.
And give us everyone within the age range of like 20 to 40. Mm. Like that was it. That's the list. And if they're good, so be it. And if they're bad, they don't care. A lot of the time. Yeah. There's a lot of filmmakers who have enough clout to actually get who they want.
Yeah, I
remember. But that's when you're in a studio system, you have to appease the people who are giving you the money. And they probably didn't get their money by having really subtle taste in film. They're probably right. They're money people. They want yeah, binary systems. This is successful. This is not. Tom Hanks makes money. Bruce Willis makes money. Ergo, we put Tom Hanks and Bruce Willis in the same movie. It will make money, right? Mm-hmm. No, that's not necessarily how it works.
I do love the stories when like supporting actors or smaller actors like directors will fight to have them in the movie.
Yeah.
Whether or not they have clout, the director will really sort of put their foot down and they'll make compromises to get that actor. And my favorite case of this is actually Hellboy. Guillermo del Toro directed Hellboy. It's a comic book movie about a demon guy.
Yeah.
And he really wanted Ron Perlman.
Well, that's the protagonist of the film.
He's the protagonist of the movie, and he's like, okay, what other stars can we get? Can we get some wrestlers in here? And Guillermo del Toro said, no, I watch Beauty and the Beast and all these monster movies that he plays monsters
well,
in.
Well, he already worked with them.
He's like, I want Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
He's like, well, you can't have Ron Perlman. He doesn't open big blockbusters. No, Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
Okay, fine, Ron Perlman, but we're going to take off the cement hand. No, cement hand. Does he have to have a tail? Yes, he has to have a tail. Like, he needed Hellboy to, like, look a very specific way with a specific actor, and he got it.
Yeah.
And you know what? I like that Hellboy.
That's pretty good.
I like the way that Hellboy looks.
I think they're both good.
I don't like the second Hellboy. I like the first Hellboy.
That's fine. but I digress. And there's a lot of bullshit stories about that. Sometimes they work out good. Sometimes they don't. Here's a classic example. Here's an interesting case. A Time to Kill. Mm-hmm. Big blockbuster John Grisham adaptation.
It wasn't Matthew McConaughey at first.
It was originally the Time to Kill, directed by Joel Schumacher, starring. It was big Matthew McConaughey's big breakout role. The first time he got to star in a movie. But originally it had been cast with Woody Harrelson. John Grisham
would have been quite a different film.
Would have been very, I think it would have been a good film, but it would have been a very different film. John Grisham, I forget the exact details. Like he knew some people who were involved in some of the like handful of like post Natural Born Killers attempts at copycat crimes. Mm-hmm. So he really didn't like Woody Harrelson.
Oh, okay.
So he said no Woody Harrelson. And so what they decided to do was Joel Schumacher fought, said, hey, listen, we cast Matthew McConaughey in this small role in the movie as a Klansman.
Wasn't he the Kiefer Sutherland role?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a small role. He's playing a Klansman. He's a bad guy. But he's devilishly handsome, super charismatic. I know he can do this role. Why don't we give him the lead role? We still have all these other huge stars in the movie. Sandra Bullock, Kevin Spacey, back when that meant something. Samuel L. Jackson. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a good cast. We can afford to have our protagonist be this new guy, and we can even use that as like a marketing strategy. Comes in this hot new actor. And they went for it, and they ended up just casting Kiefer Sutherland in that role. It's one of the few movies Kiefer Sutherland and Donald Sutherland are both in. They have no scenes together. It's kind of funny.
Just a coincidence.
But yeah, that was Joel Schumacher having faith that Matthew McConaughey, who had been cast as like, what, the 10th lead in that movie, all of a sudden elevated to the lead. Matthew McConaughey kills in that movie.
He's great in that
film. He's really good. Like, there's a reason that made him a star. He's
got a big Oscar speech at the end that he nails.
Yeah, he's great. Mm. He's one of his better roles. Like, he's really, really good. So, it can work. And with something like The Bonfire of the Vanities, you're running into the situation where there's a whole bunch of people who are cast simply because they were big at the time.
Yeah.
And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. There's an interesting scenario where Morgan Freeman plays a judge in this movie. And Morgan Freeman was a known actor. He'd already received Academy Award nominations for Street Smart, which if you've never seen Street Smart with Christopher Reeve, holy shit, that's a good movie. He was also, wasn't he nominated for Driving Miss Daisy?
Yeah, I think he was.
Yeah, so Driving Miss Daisy had already come out, won Best Picture. He was a known commodity. Everyone, very well-respected actor, and that would only solidify over the 90s as he would do stuff like The Shawshank Redemption, but and Seven, and so on. They cast him as a judge. As written, the judge was not a black guy. The judge, they originally wanted to cast Walter Matthau, and Walter Matthau wanted $1 million, so they said, no, we'll get Morgan Freeman.
No, you pay Walter Matthau.
You should, well, first off, Walter Matthau is worth $1 million.
I was about to say, if you really want Walter Matthau, you pay his price.
Yeah, he's
worth it. Yeah.
He's amazing. He would have been really, really good in this. But the role was written... This is a movie that is very much about racial tension.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about it, as the story progresses, boy, does it not handle that theme well. And it's actually really insulting and arguably really racist. And the concern, because there was concern at the time that the movie would, and the story would come across as really racist... They cast Morgan Freeman to help mitigate that, where here's a character who is in a position of authority and dignity and who, at the end of the movie, gets a big speech about human decency, which falls really flat.
Oh, God. It's kind of the worst part of the movie.
It's not Morgan Freeman's fault, but, like, he's given an unworkable speech.
Yeah.
And Morgan Freeman's really, really good in it, but clearly this role... is intended for someone to be part of a racist system and not Morgan Freeman. Mm. And so that completely changes the role and it completely changes the vibe. And frankly, it ultimately hinders the movie's message about how shitty and racist the whole legal system is.
And rather than point out that it's shitty and racist and favors white people, that's brought up.
Yes, it is.
But there's also, and this is just awful. There's, he's like a pastor. There's a pastor character.
It's not Morgan Freeman.
Another character.
I forget who plays. I'll look it up.
He's a black pastor. He has a black congregation, and they are outraged that this rich white guy is going to get away with the crime of running over a young black boy.
He's played by John Hancock. You might remember him from Roots, The Next Generations, but he did a lot of TV.
Okay.
In particular.
He was vaguely familiar. Right? I'm not...
Character actor who couldn't name him, did a lot of stuff.
This was actually
his last... He was the last movie. He died in 1992.
But the film presents the black community as... like a mob.
Yeah.
Like they're the ones demanding justice, and they're the ones depicted as sort of being unreasonable. It's all racially motivated for them.
There's a lot of opportunism that's presented. Like, here's a young man, and he just gets run over by these rich white people. That sucks. That's a terrible situation. That kid is the martyr here. That kid's mom, who is suffering, is a victim here. And then they become exploited by this reverend who is trying to manipulate the media in order to, initially it seems, manipulate the political system and make serious gains for the community. And at first you're like, okay, well, that might be...
It's a little dodgy, but noble ends. Yeah.
But then we find out later on that the ultimate grand scheme is to sue the hospital for mistreating the kid. And when the mom is like crying over her son's like comatose body, and he's just like, no, I know your son is comatose, but what if we had $10 million? She immediately stops crying. And she's just like, I do like buying things. And I'm like, what the fuck is this shit?
This is a movie that is saying any cry for racial justice is suspect.
Yeah.
And the white people are now, and there's many conversations about this. One of them from the mayor, played by F. Murray Abraham.
Who was uncredited because of a contract dispute.
Oh, God.
He wanted to be above the title. They said, no, we already have a lot of actors above the title. And F. Murray Abraham said, fuck you, don't put my name on your movie.
Fine.
Yeah.
And
he's actually good in it.
He gives a very good comedic performance, I think. But it's a really horrible kind of role.
Yeah.
Where he is now in this position where he has to find... a white savior who is being pilloried by the black community to save in order to make himself look good to the rich white people who are funding his campaign.
So initially,
now that is a good sort of a good scoundrel character to put in a satire, isn't it?
That feels like a whole season of The Wire.
Yeah.
And you could do
yeah.
that. Like, the idea that here's someone who initially is throwing Tom Hanks to the wolves, legally speaking, just because they want to show... And Morgan Freeman has a speech about this. Like, 99% of the people that are being pushed through the legal system are people of color.
Yeah.
But in an election year, they want to at least show that they're not showing complete favoritism. And so they want one high-profile, rich white person to throw in jail. And that becomes, like, the sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
Where, like, okay, well, so we sacrifice Tom Hanks, but now every other rich white person gets to get away with everything. And that's really fucked up and kind of dramatically intriguing. And they don't really commit to that, do they?
If you're going to write a story about corruption, yes, address that. But this isn't... we're trying to put way too much sympathy onto Tom Hanks.
Yes.
And we're also casting a lot of aspersions on racial justice.
And the concept.
The very concept of racial justice and how those seeking racial justice are disingenuous. And they're seeking it because, golly, they're troublemakers, aren't they? I think they even use the word troublemakers, is a huge racist bell.
Yeah.
That's like that word. I don't think they use the U word, but...
I know what you mean, we're not going to say that
I don't want to say it out loud, because
we're not going to say that shit out loud.
Hugely racist word.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the implication that this movie is making.
Yeah.
I don't think Brian De Palma was even thinking about it.
I think what Brian De Palma thinks he's getting at, and this is just speculation, obviously, but I feel like what Brian De Palma thought he was getting at is he's telling this story about how literally all of society is corrupted by avarice.
Yeah.
Like, whether you have money or merely want money, that's a level of corruption that can affect us all. And maybe that's an interesting story to tell, but when you undermine legitimate, real issues... in the process, you're not telling a story that mocks wealth. You're telling a story that mocks people who have real problems.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems. That's the biggest problem with this movie, is that it's not sure who's angry at. It's clearly angry. It's clearly angry. There's clearly frustration and rage and mounting tension and, like, scenes where, like, Tom Hanks is running around his million-dollar apartment with a shotgun while everyone's, like, not sure if this is funny or not and if they should run. Like...
And if he was, like... losing his shit and shooting holes and everybody just sort of laughed it off. That'd be good, like a good nightmare sequence, like something out of the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And the idea is it doesn't matter how mad or violent you are. If you're a rich white guy, that's just part of your world.
And if you want to listen to we don't often talk a lot about the score for a movie, when we review films at length, because typically scores are quite competent and you can just sort of say and they did it well, and I don't need to go into a lot of detail, but listen to Dave Grusin's award-winning composer. I'm not saying he's a terrible composer, but this is clearly a film where nobody knew what anyone else was doing. Listen to Dave Grusin's score in that scene. That is a scene where Tom Hanks is completely at the end of his rope. He's not sure if he says he wants to kill himself or kill everybody else in the room. He's being thrown out of his apartment. He's a pariah in the media. He's lost his wife. He's lost his kids. By the way, his daughter is played by Kirsten Dunst in her first performance.
That's right.
trivia, not really important. She's fine. He only has two scenes. But he's lost everything. And he's completely at the end of his rope, and he's running around this room with a shotgun, and people don't know how to respond to him. And the music, when he finally gets everyone to leave his apartment, is triumphant, as though he has achieved something, as though there is some great moral truth that has been unveiled. No. That's not what's going on in that scene, on no level. Is that a rational interpretation of what's going on with that scene? The musical score in a film is like a highlighter. It sort of makes sure that certain elements of the storyline are underlined or in italics, where you just sort of emphasize the emotional significance of a scene. Sometimes you're selling it exactly as it is. The scene where Henry Thomas says goodbye to E.T. It's a sad... incredible coming-of-age moment. John Williams sells it as such. It is beautiful. Sometimes it's an ironic counterpoint. Here, it's just wrong. Like, imagine the end of E.T.
They did it incorrectly.
Like, imagine if at the end of E.T., you've seen E.T. or you know the scene, you've seen it, like, referenced and stuff, where, like, you know, I'm going to miss you forever, E.T., and E.T.'s like, I'll be right here, kid. And you're sort of like, oh, that's nice. Like, if you imagine if, I can't do E.T.'s voice, so I didn't bother. Imagine if that scene, instead of having that sweeping John Williams, like, imagine if it was like the Benny Hill theme. Like, whole scene changes, doesn't it?
I've seen, and you can find experiments like this on YouTube. That scene from E.T., you can find, there's a funny clip on YouTube where somebody just removed the score and added like ambient sound effects.
And it's just awkward.
And it's just like it's really slow moving, and like you hear a dog barking in the distance. And you hear like E.T.'s feet on the ramp as he goes back up, plang, 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 plang. It's like the most, it becomes this really banal scene.
Yeah.
Because that scene is about the music.
And maybe if you'd seen the whole movie, you would be so emotionally invested that you would be less distracted by that. But that's why we have the score, to make sure it's a shortcut. It gets you to that emotional involvement that you would have if you were there. Here, what's the emotional involvement we have in that Tom Hanks scene? It ain't triumph.
Yeah.
It's desperation. It's fear. Yeah, it's panic.
There's a lot to... And this still happens from time to time when a bad score will underline the wrong part about a scene. I remember when... the latest Wonder Woman film came out. There's a scene where the Kristen Wiig character beats up somebody who had sexually assaulted her earlier.
Oh, yeah, I remember that,
And it's because of the music in that scene, it's depicted as this sort of turn-to-villainy moment for her.
She's done something so horrible. She's done so hard.
She beat up a guy who assaulted her and might have killed her for all we know.
Yeah, she defended herself, and she didn't kill him. And, like, so, like, this is not her turning evil. This is her gaining power. Yeah, like, my sympathy in this scene.
If she beat that guy up and then, like pulled his brain out with her bare hands, it's like, okay, now something's changed.
A bit far. Like, maybe that's a step. But, like,
and also, you did something kind of grotesque. Like, if you wanted to sell that she's gone over the line, change that during the scene.
If you want to change that, if you want to change that scene so that it's heroic or that it's so that it's evil, have her not beat up an attempted sexual assaulter.
Yeah, have her beat up like
a different guy, some random person. Would be it.
Like a guy who just bumped into her on the street. And
Then she started a fight.
She starts a fight with him and nearly kills him.
That maybe you could get away with. But we know he tried to attack her earlier, and he would have if Wonder Woman hadn't stopped her.
And starts doing it again, too. Yeah, attacking her again.
So clearly this is a pattern of behavior. This guy is a problem. You're on my... I'm on your side, man. Wonder Woman should be on your side, too. Like, the whole scene's fucked up. But again, it's a perfect example. You're absolutely right. Where the music is telling a very different story than what we're seeing on screen. And it's confusing, and it's weird, and it's showing that people are not on the same page here.
The score for The Bonfire of the Vanities is full of these heroic crescendos. Yeah. You don't put heroic crescendos in a satire.
No.
Unless you're using them ironically.
Yeah, and they're not. They mean it. Mm. When there's this whole, like... At the end of the movie, where Tom Hanks like perjures himself in order to reveal the truth, not an uninteresting way to end the film, but like it is sad what's happening here. It is gross happening here.
He perjures himself to reveal that in order to throw his mistress under the bus.
Yeah,
and he gets off the hook, and Melanie Griffith never pays any prices
that we know of.
Not in the movie. It's never mentioned.
Yeah, like the idea.
As far as we know, she got off scot-free.
He has a recording of her admitting that she was driving the car and she hit the kid. And unfortunately,
through some plot machinations, somebody was bugging their apartment.
There's this weird thing, actually, and I wonder how much of this. I wonder if someone actually saw this movie and was trying to like ruin The Bonfire of the Vanities more, because there's this whole plot point where Tom Hanks has this recording that someone had illegally took of Melanie Griffith, like, in her apartment, because they were trying to prove she was doing something else.
No, it was a subletting scheme.
Yeah,
catch her at something else.
She was staying in someone else's sublet, and she wasn't supposed to, and the landlord had bugged her apartment in order to prove that she was living there illegally. All of that is wrong and shouldn't have been done. But in any case, loud subway.
you can hear the train.
We have an elevated train near our... It's actually not a subway, it's an elevated train. But anyway... Where was it going with this? So he has a recording of Melanie Griffith saying that she did it. However, his lawyer says, okay, here's the thing though. This recording was not taken by you. It was taken illegally and we cannot, submit it in court. Now, different states have different laws about how legal a recording of someone is.
Yeah, as evidence.
As evidence. But I'm pretty sure that if you weren't responsible for illegally recording it, it can still be accepted in court, because that was a major plot point in the movie The Rainmaker.
That's right.
Where as long as you
weren't responsible... I remember really liking
it. It's a good movie. It's not the best John Grisham movie, but it's a very good movie, and it's a very legally accurate movie. Like, I've talked to...
some actual lawyers.
Well, I haven't talked to them. I was thinking if I actually interviewed someone. I thought I did, but no, I was just remembering something else. No, I've read stuff and seen interviews with lawyers where they say The Rainmaker is one of the most accurate depictions of the legal system in the movies. But yeah, that's the whole thing, where if you were not responsible for illegally acquiring evidence, but the evidence exists anyway, you can still submit that because it's still real. So I'm not sure that would apply in New York, and maybe if someone's a lawyer who's listening, you can tell us whether or not that's true, but I'm pretty sure that because they weren't responsible for illegally recording someone, that's still submittable. That's still admissible in court. But in any case, so in order to introduce this in court, rather than introduce it into evidence, say, hey, we have a recording of Melanie Griffith saying she did it, he just plays it in the middle of her deposition, and I'm like, you can't do that. At best, the best you can hope for right now is a mistrial. Yeah. Because you totally fucked up the system. You totally fucked up the order and everything. This was not supposed to happen. So you've just screwed yourself into a mistrial at best. But now, they probably won't pursue it because there's evidence that she did it afterwards, but like it's not the ending you're looking for.
But the way the film presents it, he plays that recording in court without being prompted.
Yeah.
Just sort of hits a button in the middle, of somebody talking.
And it's queued up to something like embarrassing about his penis, by the way. It's about like, oh yeah, my penis isn't good for sex today. And she's like, that's okay, that's the way I like it. And he's like, this is a weird bit. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Why didn't you cue it up to the part where she was admitting she tried to commit murder? Why didn't you commit to why would you cue it up at the part?
But
why would you do that?
But yeah, what happens, Judge Morgan Freeman calls them up to the bench and says, is this your recording? He says, yes, it is. He's not on the stand, but he lies right to the judge's face.
Well, they say technically you're still under oath, which I don't know how true that is, but I guess he's basically saying if you lie to me, you would be legally culpable. Yeah.
So he is
putting himself on the line.
But yeah, he says, yes, it's mine. And right then, Judge bangs the gavel and says, nope. He's off the hook.
Yeah.
That's it.
I'm allowed to do that for some reason.
And
then everyone's mad, and then Morgan Freeman gives a speech about human decency, which could not come across as less sincere if Morgan Freeman was dressed like a clown.
I will say this. Morgan Freeman is such a damn good actor.
Yes.
That he sells it with sincerity.
Yeah.
There is no eye roll.
No.
He's not coloring it in such a way where there's like something shifty going on or he doesn't care.
In another better movie, I would believe every second of that speech because he's a great actor. In this movie, it doesn't fly. There's nothing about this movie that suggests that human decency exists.
Yep.
So when he says, why can't you all just be decent? And everyone in the movie who's been horrible and shitty and screwing each other over for a percentage this entire time, everyone sits down and goes, yeah, fair enough. You did not earn a Capra-esque ending here. This is not Capra-esque.
No.
At best, this could have been like Sturges-esque, something like The Great McGinty, something that's kind of biting and mean. But De Palma, man, he is not...
He's not that kind of director.
He's not a social... If he does social commentary, he does it through wild, pulpy thriller. And as a result, he's allowed to be really broad. Here, he's dealing with so many serious, relevant issues. So many serious, relevant themes. So many things that really matter to real people on a daily basis. That his lack of nuance is borderline criminal here. Like, it's a horrible thing. To take on this, I don't think this material would work very well. There was some talk about maybe doing this as a mini series on Amazon a few years ago. Maybe if someone had done it who was talented, clever, maybe possible. But this is a lot to bite off.
Yeah,
and I don't think De Palma was ever the right person to do this. He does not have the tone.
Yeah, there are contemporaries that were working at the same time as De Palma in the late 80s who could have done so much better with this. Mike Nichols would have done great. Verhoeven would have done great.
Oh my God, can you imagine how biting Verhoeven's would have been?
Verhoeven would have been great.
That's a good one. I imagine, here's one who I actually could imagine could do it. I don't know if he would have done it at this point in his career. But I would love to see what Spike Lee would do with this, because he would know who to be mad at.
Spike Lee would have done great.
He can point fingers at everybody and have like the moral high ground, and you could keep the film centered while keeping it mean.
Yeah,
and I think that would be really great.
Spike Lee, speaking of angry filmmakers, this was back when Oliver Stone was angry.
Yeah,
Oliver Stone would have done a good job with this.
I don't know if it would be good. It would have been interesting, that's for sure.
But yeah,
he's very abrasive. I don't know if he, I think he might have oversold it, but maybe.
Would have been
better than this.
Yeah, I mean, look at something like Natural Born Killers. It's like, I'm going to use every camera that's ever been invented to make this movie. And
there was some rumor, or talk that Steven Spielberg was pursued for this, and I do not want to see that movie.
That's
not good marriage material at all.
Pollock would have done a good job on this.
Pollock would have done okay. He doesn't really have a sense of humor like that. Like he's
no, but he would have made a good serious movie.
I'm not saying he hasn't made good comedies, but I think that's the thing. I think this needs to be a blistering satire. Okay. And Pollock has made comedy, don't get me wrong, but I don't think he's a blistering satirist.
Okay.
I think that's what we... I think Verhoeven is the best one I've heard so far.
Verhoeven or Spike Lee.
I think those two would have been just perfect. Because
they're both very funny, very energetic filmmakers, but they also understand like rage and satire.
They understand what's important, and they know what not to make fun of,
right?
Or at the very least, what not to make fun of. You can like handle it in a funny way, but you have to keep the actual subject serious, and that's hard to do. And boy, did De Palma whiff it. The Bonfire of the Vanities stinks, and I am amazed actually. It's one of those movies where it was so high profile. And it was so, like, notorious, even at the time.
Such a turkey, yeah.
At the time, this was, like, completely despised. There were a few positive reviews here and there, but mostly people didn't like it and didn't make money.
And even the positive reviews, I read a couple, are, like, really super qualified.
Pretty mild. Like, you know, yeah, but, you know, I think Efrem Abraham was good, like, that kind of thing. Yeah. So I was shocked that the Golden Raspberry Awards didn't call this the worst movie of the year. And I was like, what the hell else?
The Golden Raspberries, they go for the lowest hanging fruit.
They do.
Yeah, they like, never do anything subtle or nuanced.
Like 1 year later, they would go after Hudson Hawk, and then they would do an Indecent Proposal, which isn't even that bad. It's just stupid. Like, it's the Cocktail had won. Like, that's just kind of a dumb movie. It's not even that bad. It's just dumb. There were two movies that beat The Bonfire of the Vanities. There was a tie for Worst Picture in 1990. One is a film I've actually never seen.
Okay.
The Adventures of Ford Fairlane.
Oh, my sister liked that movie.
Did you like that movie?
I didn't watch it.
Okay. The other one, and this one, I have seen this movie, and as hard as it may seem, this actually is a worse movie than The Bonfire of the Vanities. Ghosts Can't Do It.
Oh, no.
Have you seen Ghosts Can't Do It?
I've seen a couple relevant scenes that make me vomit a little bit.
Ghosts Can't Do It stars Anthony Quinn as a wealthy old man who is married to a young Beau Derek. And he dies, and his ghost hangs around for two reasons. One, he wants to find someone for Beau Derek to fuck. It's really gross. Two, he wants to help Bo Derek save his company from Donald Trump. Not someone playing a Donald Trump type character. Literally Donald Trump playing himself. Mm. And the movie sells him as like the ultimate like deal maker. And like there's a bit where Bo Derek actually like wins one over at him and he's like, checkmate, you're very good. It's like you're like, oh god. And like even the credits say, yes, that was really Donald Trump. Mm. Like, yeah, thanks. The movie is almost unwatchable.
You know he insists on every single one of those things.
I'm sure he did. The movie is nearly unwatchable. Bo Derek has to do some truly humiliating shit.
Including acting with Donald Trump.
Well, I wasn't going to go over there, but yes. Yeah. That movie is actually... Like, Bonfire of the Vanities is a bad movie, but at least it feels like a real movie. I don't know if I can say that for Ghosts Can't Do It. You want to see one of the shittiest movies of the 1990s. Boy, they peaked early with Ghosts Can't Do It. Like, it's really fucking awful. But I digress. But anyway, that is it for the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club this week. Thank everybody who has been joining us, obviously. And thank everybody who voted. Every episode of the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club is chosen by our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We pick a streaming service and we pick a category. And then we each pick two nominees. And the only rule is it has to be on that streaming service, in that category, genre, filmmaker, decade, whatever. And we each pick two films that we either have never seen, or maybe we saw them once when we were kids and we barely remembered them. Yeah. We'll cut a little slack with that. Next time, our nominees are all sci-fi films that are available on Amazon Prime. So if you have the Amazon streaming service, you'll know that a lot of films are available, but you can only have to pay a couple bucks to rent them. These are the ones that come free with the service right now.
Yeah.
And the current crop of nominees are The Apple.
Which you've never seen.
I have been waiting for a good opportunity to see The Apple. I keep meaning to see it in theaters, but God only knows when that opportunity is ever going to come up again. The Apple is a spectacularly notorious sci-fi musical about a couple of kids.
From Moose Jaw, Canada.
Yeah.
Come to the big city.
And they're going
to
become big rock stars, and of course they're corrupted by people who are corrupting them, and music's bad, and it's the 80s.
They're not just corrupted by people. They're corrupted by the devil.
My apologies.
Vladek Shaybal plays Satan, and they're like... And it's an Adam and Eve parable, hence the title, The Apple.
All right.
These innocents from Canada.
It's considered one of the worst movies ever made. Next up is...
directed by Menachem Golem of Golan Globus. That is the Canon Film Group.
Yeah. Next up is a film by Curtis Harrington, who is a celebrated horror filmmaker from the 60s and 70s in particular. Queen of Blood, a.k.a. Planet of Blood. Which is about vampires in space, and it is considered a direct inspiration for Ridley Scott's Alien. Never seen it, always wanted to. This might be my opportunity. And then you picked a couple of films. Joe Dante's The Explorers, which is about a couple of kids who end up getting mysterious messages from outer space and their dreams and decide to build a spaceship and investigate... Into the farthest reaches of the galaxy.
Build a spaceship just in their backyard.
Yeah.
And go into space with it.
I love this movie, and if we get to rewatch it, I'm really excited. But Whitney's never seen it, so that's exciting.
Yeah, never seen Explorers.
And then lastly, a film I'm actually not very familiar with, so tell me a little bit about Message from Space.
Message from Space, it's one of those cult movies that I always heard a lot about, and it has like it's alien invasion flick. Yeah.
And it's Kenji Fukasaku, who ended up doing Battle Royale.
That's right.
Which is probably what he's best known for now.
Yeah. And... it's got a really cool alien in it with a big blue head.
Awesome. All right, so those are the options. That poll should be available probably around the time this podcast goes live. And if you want to join us at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, you can vote for it. Even $1 a month gets you the opportunity to vote for episodes of The Streaming Club and Cancel Too Soon and other various options as well. We also have a lot of exclusive shows over on the Patreon, including a show all about every single episode of the 1960s Batman, every single Star Trek ever made, episode by episode. We're doing podcasts about Disney, the Academy Awards, commentary tracks. We want to make sure our patrons have like a lot of extra stuff because we couldn't do any of these shows without you. And we just want to make sure that you're well taken care of because we love every single one of you. And if you can't afford to be a patron, we love you too. Don't worry about that. I just want to make sure our patrons know that we appreciate their donations and their sacrifice. So, if you can't afford to join up, leave us a review wherever you find us. That would really, really help. Star rating, a couple of sentences, be honest, obviously. Of course, you can also find us on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
If you want to send us an email, talk about anything we discussed on this episode or anything else you want to talk about, you can always email us letters@criticallyacclaimed.net, and we might read your email on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail. If you're a snail mail type person, if you just love sending people snails, you can also send us a letter or whatever you would like at our P.O. Box.
We have an actual mailing address now. It's the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565. That's 641565. Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And, Oh, and also we have I have a soap store with M. Lapis Da Silva. So if you want to head over to Etsy, look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. We have a lot of exciting new soaps that we have debuted in the month of June, some of them for Pride Month. There's a Father's Day gift set. There's a lot of really, really cool stuff out there, and we hope you enjoy it. And thank you to everybody who has already purchased some of our soap. The reviews have been really, really great so far, and we're very grateful to you. We'll be back next week with whichever wins the sci-fi film on Amazon Prime wins the poll. That should be pretty clear on the Patreon page if you want to check it out and follow along. That should poll should run for only a day or two, so should be easy to find out soon. And I guess that's that. Thanks for listening to The Streaming Club is how I've chosen to end this podcast today. Yeah.